If Sir Boris wants for killing, Osney could do it easy enough. Why? Has Boris done some treason?
No, she said. But Osney has. Brian. They came upon the first corpse, a mile from the crossroads. He swung beneath the limb of a dead tree whose blackened trunk still bore the scars of the lightning that had killed it. The carrion crows had been at work on his face, and wolves had feasted on his lower legs where they dangled near the ground. Only bones and rags remained below his knees, along with one well-chewed shoe, half covered by mud and mould.
"What's he have in his mouth?"
asked Podrick. Brian had to steel herself to look. His face was grey and green and ghastly, his mouth open and distended. Someone had shoved a jagged white rock between his teeth. "A rock or salt?" said Septon Merribold. 50 yards further on, they spied the second body. The scavengers had torn him down, so what remained of him was strewn on the ground beneath a frayed rope looped about the limb of an elm. Brian might have ridden past him unawares, if Dog had not sniffed him out, and loped into the woods for a closer smell. "What do you have there, Dog?" Sir Hyle dismounted, strode after the dog, and came up with a half-helm. The dead man's skull was still inside it, along with some worms and beetles.
"Good steel," he pronounced, "and not too badly dinted. Though the lion's lost his head. Pod, would you like a helm?"
"Not that one. It's got worms in it."
"Worms wash out, lad. You're squeamish as a girl."
Brian scowled at him.
"It's too big for him.
He'll grow into it."
"I don't want to," said Podrick.
Sir Hyle shrugged and tossed the broken helm back into the weeds, lion crest and all. Dog barked and went to lift his leg against the tree. After that, hardly 100 yards went by without a corpse. They dangled under ash and alder, beech and birch, larch and elm, hoary old willows and stately chestnut trees. Each man wore a noose around his neck and swung from a length of hempen rope, and each man's mouth was packed with salt. Some wore cloaks of grey or blue or crimson, though rain and snow had faded them so badly that it was hard to tell one colour from another. Others had badges sewn on their breasts. Brian spied axes, arrows, several salmon, a pine tree, an oak leaf, beetles, bantams, a boar's head, half a dozen tridents.
"Broken men," she realized. "Dregs from a dozen armies. The leavings of the lords."
Some of the dead men had been bald and some bearded, some young and some old, some short, some tall, some fat, some thin. Swollen in death, with faces gnawed and rotten, they all looked the same.
"On a gallows tree, all men are brothers."
Brian had read that in a book, though she could not recall which one. It was Hyle Hunt who finally put words to what all of them had realized.
"These are the men who raided salt pens."
"May the father judge them harshly," said Merribald, who had been a friend to the town's aged septon.
Who they were did not concern Brian half so much as who had hanged them. The noose was the preferred method of execution for Beric Dondarrion and his band of outlaws, it was said. If so, the so-called Lightning Lord might well be near. Dog barked, and Septon Merribald glanced about and frowned.
"And shall we keep a brisker pace? The sun will soon be setting, and corpses make poor company by night. These were dark and dangerous men alive. I doubt that death will have improved them."
"There we disagree," said Sir Hyle. "These are just the sort of fellows who are most improved by death."
All the same, he put his heels into his horse, and they moved a little faster. Farther on, the trees began to thin, though not the corpses. The woods gave way to muddy fields, tree limbs to gibbets. Clouds of crows rose screeching from the bodies as the travellers came near and settled again once they had passed.
These were evil men,
Brian reminded herself. Yet the sight still made her sad. She forced herself to look at every man in turn, searching for familiar faces. A few she thought she recognized from Harrenhal, but their condition made it hard to be certain. None had a hound's head helm, but few had helms of any sort. Most had been stripped of arms, armor, and boots before they were strung up. When Podrick asked the name of the inn where they hoped to spend the night, Septon Meribald seized upon the question eagerly, perhaps to take their minds off the grisly sentinels along the roadside.
"The Old Inn, some call it. There's been an inn there for many hundreds of years, though this inn was only raised during the reign of the first Jaehaerys, the king who built the King's Road. Jaehaerys and his queen slept there during their journeys, it is said. For a time the inn was known as the Two Crowns in their honour, until one innkeep built a bell tower and changed it to the Bell Ringer Inn. Later it passed to a crippled knight named Long John Heddle, who took up ironworking when he grew too old to fight. He forged a new sign for the yard, a three-headed dragon of black iron that he hung from a wooden post. The beast was so big it had to be made in a dozen pieces, joined with rope and wire. When the wind blew, it would clank and clatter, so the inn became known far and wide as the Clanking Dragon.
"Is the dragon sign still there?" asked Podrick.
"No," said Septon Meribald. "When the smith's son was an old man, a bastard son of the fourth Aegon rose up in rebellion against his true-born brother, and took for his sigil a black dragon. These lands belonged to Lord Darry then, and his lordship was fiercely loyal to the king. The sight of the black iron dragon made him wroth, so he cut down the post, hacked the side to pieces, and cast them into the river. One of the dragon's heads washed up on the quiet isle, many years later, though by that time it was red with rust. The innkeep never hung another sign, so men forgot the dragon and took to calling the place the River Inn. In those days the Triton flowed beneath its back door, and half its rooms were built out over the water. Guests could throw a line out of their window and catch trout, it said. There was a ferry landing here as well, so travellers could cross to Lord Harroway's town and Whitewall's.
"We left the Trident south of here, and have been riding north and west, not toward the river, but away from it."
"Aye, my lady," the Septon said, "the river moved. 70 years ago it was, or was it 80? It was when old Masha Heddle's grandfather kept the place. It was her who told me all this history. A kindly woman, Masha, fond of sour leaf and honey cakes. When she did not have a room for me, she would let me sleep beside the hearth, and she never sent me on my way without some bread and cheese and a few stale cakes."
"Is she the innkeep now?" asked Podrick.
"No, the lions hanged her. After they moved on, I heard that one of her nephews tried opening the inn again, but the wars had made the roads too dangerous for common folk to travel, so there was little custom. He brought in whores, but even that could not save him. Some lord killed him as well, I hear."
Sir Hyle made a wry face.
I never dreamed that keeping an inn could be so deadly dangerous. It's being common born that is dangerous when the great lords play their Game of Thrones," said Septon Meribald. "Isn't that so, Dog?"
Dog barked agreement.
"So," said Podrick, "does the inn have a name now?"
"The small folk call it the Crossroads Inn. Elder brother told me that two of Masha Heddle's nieces have opened it to trade once again."
He raised his staff.
"If the gods are good, that smoke rising beyond the hangmen will be from its chimneys."
"They could call the place the Gallows Inn," Sir Hyle said. By any name, the inn was large, rising 3 stories above the muddy roads, its walls and turrets and chimneys made of fine white stone that glimmered pale and ghostly against the grey sky. Its south wing had been built upon heavy wooden pilings above a cracked and sunken expanse of weeds and dead brown grass. A thatch-roof stable and a bell tower were attached to the north side. The Hellsprawl was surrounded by a low wall of broken white stones overgrown by moss.
At least no one has burned it down.
At Saltpans they had found only death and desolation. By the time Brian and her companions were ferried over from the quiet isle, the survivors had fled, and the dead had been given to the ground. But the corpse of the town itself remained, ashen and unburied. The air still smelled of smoke, and the cries of the seagulls floating overhead sounded almost human, like the lamentations of lost children. Even the castle had seemed forlorn and abandoned. Grey as the ashes of the town around it, the castle consisted of a square keep girded by a curtain wall, built so as to overlook the harbour. It was closed tight as Brian and the others led their horses off the ferry, nothing moving on its battlements but banners. It took a quarter hour of dog barking and Septon Marybold knocking on the front gate with his quarterstaff before a woman appeared above them to demand their business. By that time the ferry had departed, and it had begun to rain.
"I am a holy Septon, good lady," Marybold had shouted up, "and these are honest travellers. We seek shelter from the rain, and a place by your fire for the night."
The woman had been unmoved by his appeals.
"The closest inn is at the crossroads to the west," she replied. "We want no strangers here. Begone!"
Once she vanished, neither Marybold's prayers, dog's barks, nor Sir Hyle's curses could bring her back. In the end they had spent the night in the woods beneath a shelter made of woven branches. There was life at the crossroads inn, though. Even before they reached the gate, Brian heard the sound. A hammering, faint but steady. It had a steely ring.
"A forge," Sir Hyle said. "Either they have themselves a smith, or the old innkeep's ghost is making another iron dragon."
He put his heels into his horse.
"I hope they have a ghostly cook as well. A crisp roast chicken would set the world aright."
The inn's yard was a sea of brown mud that sucked at the hooves of the horses. The clang of steel was louder here, and Brian saw the red glow of the forge down past the far end of the stables, behind an ox-cart with a broken wheel. She could see horses in the stables, too, and a small boy was swinging from the rusted chains of the weathered gibbet that loomed above the yard. Four girls stood on the inn's porch watching him. The youngest was no more than two, and naked. The oldest, 9 or 10, stood with her arms protectively about the little one.
"Girls," Sir Hyle called to them, "run and fetch your mother."
The boy dropped from the chain and dashed off toward the stables. The four girls stood fidgeting. After a moment one said,
"We have no mothers," and another added, "I had one, but I killed her."
The oldest of the four stepped forward, pushing the little one behind her skirts.
"Who are you?"
she demanded.
"Honest travellers seeking shelter. My name is Brian, and this is Septon Marybold, who is well known through the Riverlands. The boy is my squire, Podrick Payne. The knight, Sir Hyle Hunt."
The hammering stopped suddenly. The girl on the porch looked them over, weary, as only a 10-year-old can be.
"I'm Willow. Will you be wanting beds?"
"Beds and ale and hot food to fill our bellies," said Sir Hyle Hunt as he dismounted. "Are you the innkeep?"
She shook her head.
"That's my sister Jane. She's not here. All we have to eat is horse meat. If you come for horse, there are none. My sister run them off. We have beds, though. Some feather beds, but more are straw."
"And all have fleas, I don't doubt," said Sir Hyle.
"Do you have coin to pay? Silver?"
Sir Hyle laughed.
"Silver? For a knight's bed and a haunch of horse? Do you mean to rob us, child?"
We'll have Silver, else you can sleep in the woods with the dead men.
Willow glanced toward the donkey and the casks and bundles on his back.
Is that food? Where did you get it?
Maidenpool, said Merriwald. Dog barked. Do you question all your guests this way? Asked Sahile.
We don't have so many guests. Not like before the war. It's mostly sparrows on the roads these days, or worse.
Worse? Brian asked.
Thieves,
said a boy's voice from the stable.
Robbers.
Brian turned and saw a ghost.
Renly?
No hammer blow to the heart could have felt her half so hard.
My lord,
she gasped.
Lord?
The boy pushed back a lock of black hair that had fallen across his eyes.
I'm just a smith.
He's not Renly, Brian realized. Renly is dead.
Renly died in my arms. A man of 21. This is only a boy.
A boy who looked as Renly had the first time he came to Tarth.
No, younger. His jaw is squarer. His brows bushier.
Renly had been lean and lithe, whereas this boy had the heavy shoulders and muscular right arm so often seen on smiths. He wore a long leather apron, but under it his chest was bare. A dark stubble covered his cheeks and chin, and his hair was a thick black mop that grew down past his ears. King Renly's hair had been that same coal black, but his had always been washed and brushed and combed. Sometimes he cut it short, and sometimes he let it fall loose to his shoulders, or tied it back behind his head with a golden ribbon. But it was never tangled or matted with sweat, and though his eyes had been the same deep blue, Lord Renly's eyes had always been warm and welcoming, full of laughter, whereas this boy's eyes brimmed with anger and suspicion. Septon Merrybold saw it too.
We mean no harm, lad. When Masha Heddle owned this inn, she always had a honey cake for me. Sometimes she even let me have a bed if the inn was not full. She's dead, the boy said. The lion's anger.
Oh, hanging seems your favourite sport in these parts, said Sir Hyle Hunt. Would that I had some land hereabouts. I'd plant hemp, sell rope, and make my fortune.
All these children, Brian said to the girl Willow. Are they your sisters, or brothers, kin and cousins?
No,
Willow was staring at her in a way that she knew well.
They're just, I don't know. The sparrows bring them here. Sometimes others find their own way. If you're a woman, why are you dressed up like a man?
Septon Merrybold answered,
Lady Brian is a warrior maid upon a quest. Just now, though, she's in need of a dry bed and a warm fire. As are we all, my old bones say it's going to rain again and soon. Do you have rooms for us?
No,
said the boy smith.
Yes,
said the girl Willow. They glared at one another. Then Willow stomped her foot.
They have food, Gendry. The little ones are hungry.
She whistled, and more children appeared, as if by magic. Ragged boys with unshorn locks crept from under the porch, and furtive girls appeared in the windows overlooking the yard. Some clutched crossbows, wound and loaded.
They could call it Crossbow Inn,
Sir Hyle suggested.
Orphan Inn would be more apt, thought Brian.
What? You help them with those horses, said Willow.
Will. Put down that rock. They've not come to hurt us. Tansy, Pate, run get some wood to feed the fire. John Penny, you help the Septon with those bundles. I'll show them to some rooms.
In the end, they took three rooms adjoining each other, each boasting a feather bed, a chamber pot, and a window. Brian's room had a hearth as well. She paid a few pennies more for some wood.
Will I sleep in your room or Sir Hyle's?
Podrick asked, as she was opening the shutters.
This is not the quiet isle, she told him. You can stay with me.
Come the morrow, she meant for the two of them to strike out on their own. Septon Merrybold was going on to Nutton, Riverbend, and Lord Hathaway's town, but Brain saw no sense in following him any farther. He had Dog to keep him company, and the elder brother had persuaded her that she would not find Sansa Stark along the Trident.
"I mean to rise before the sun comes up, while Sir Hyle is still sleeping."
Brain had not forgiven him for Highgarden, and as he himself had said, Hunt had sworn no vows concerning Sansa.
"Where will we go, sir? I mean, my lady?"
Brain had no ready answer for him. They had come to the crossroads, quite literally. The place where the King's Road, the River Road, and the High Road all came together. The High Road would take them east, through the mountains, to the Vale of Arryn, where Lady Sansa's aunt had ruled until her death. West ran the River Road, which followed the course of the Red Fork to Riverrun and Sansa's great-uncle, who was besieged but still alive. Or they could ride the King's Road north, past the Twins and through the Neck with its bugs and marshes. If she could find a way past Moat Cailin and whoever held it now, the King's Road would bring them all the way to Winterfell.
"Or I could take the King's Road south," Brian thought. "I could slink back to King's Landing, confess my failure to Sir Jaime, give him back his sword, and find a ship to carry me home to Tarth, as the elder brother urged."
The thought was a bitter one. Yet there was part of her that yearned for Evenfall and her father, and another part that wondered if Jaime would comfort her should she weep upon his shoulder. That was what men wanted, wasn't it? Soft, helpless women that they needed to protect.
"Sir, my lady, I asked, where are we going?"
"Down to the common room, to supper."
The common room was crawling with children. Brian tried to count them, but they would not stand still even for an instant, so she counted some of them twice or thrice, and others not at all, until she finally gave it up. They had pushed the tables together in three long rows, and the older boys were wrestling benches from the back. Older here meant 10 or 12. Gendry was the closest thing to a man grown, but it was Willow shouting all the orders as if she were a queen in her castle and the other children were no more than servants.
"If she were highborn, command would come naturally to her, and deference to them."
Brian wondered whether Willow might be more than she appeared. The girl was too young and too plain to be Sansa Stark, but she was of the right age to be the younger sister, and even Lady Caitlin had said that Arya lacked her sister's beauty.
"Brown hair, brown eyes, skinny, could it be?"
Arya Stark's hair was brown, she recalled, but Brienne was not so sure of the colour of her eyes.
"Brown and brown. Was that it? Could it be that she did not die at Salt Pans after all?"
Outside, the last light of day was fading. Inside, Willow had 4 greasy tallow candles lit and told the girls to keep the hearth fire burning high and hot. The boys helped Podrick Payne unpack the donkey and carried in the salt cod, mutton, vegetables, nuts, and wheels of cheese, while Septon Meribald repaired to the kitchens to take charge of the porridge.
"Alas, my oranges are gone, and I doubt that I shall see another till the spring," he told one small boy. "Have you ever had an orange, lad? Squeezed one and sucked down that fine juice?"
When the boy shook his head, "No." The Septon mussed his hair.
"Then I'll bring you one come spring, if you'll be a good lad and help me stir the porridge."
Sir Hyle pulled off his boots to warm his feet by the fire. When Brian sat down next to him, he nodded at the far end of the room.
"There are bloodstains on the floor over there, where Dog is sniffing. They've been scrubbed, but the blood soaked deep into the wood, and there's no getting it out. This is the inn where Sandor Clegane killed 3 of his brother's men," she reminded him.
"It is that," Hunt agreed. "But who is to say that they were the first to die here, or that they'll be the last?"
"Are you afraid of a few children?"
"4 would be a few. 10 would be a surfeit.
This is a cacophony. Children should be wrapped in swaddling clothes and hung upon the wall until the girls grow breasts and the boys are old enough to shave.
I feel sorry for them. All of them had lost their mothers and fathers. Some have seen them slain.
Hunt rolled his eyes. Oh, I forgot I was talking to a woman. Your heart is as mushy as our septon's porridge. Can it be somewhere inside our sword's wench is a mother just squirming to give birth? What you really want is a sweet pink babe to suckle at your teat. Sir Hyle grinned. You need a man for that, I hear. A husband, preferably. Why not me?
If you still hope to win your wager,
what I want to win is you. Lord Selwyn's only living child. I've known men to wed lackwits and suckling babes for prizes a tenth the size of Tarth. I am not Renly Baratheon, I confess it, but I have the virtue of being still amongst the living. Some would say that is my only virtue. Marriage would serve the both of us, lands for me, and a castle full of these for you. He waved his hand at the children. I am capable, I assure you. I've sired at least one bastard that I know of. Have no fear, I shall not inflict her upon you. The last time I went to see her, her mother doused me with a kettle of soup. A flush crept up her neck.
My father's only 54, not too old to wed again, and get a son by his new wife.
That's a risk. If your father weds again, and if his bride proves fertile, and if the babe's a boy, oh, I've made worse wagers.
And lost them. Play your game with someone else, sir.
So speaks a maid who has never played the game with anyone. Once you do, you'll take a different view. In the dark, you'll be as beautiful as any other woman. Your lips were made for kissing.
They are lips, said Brian. All lips are the same.
And all lips are made for kissing, Hunt agreed pleasantly. Leave your chamber door unbarred tonight, and I will steal into your bed and prove the truth of what I say.
If you do, you'll be a eunuch when you leave.
Brian got up and walked away from him. Septon Marybold asked if he might lead the children in a grace, ignoring the small girl calling naked across the table.
"Aye," said Willow, snatching up the crawler before she reached the porridge.
So they bowed their heads together and thanked the father and the mother for their bounty, all but the black-haired boy from the forge, who crossed his arms against his chest and sat glowering as the others prayed. Brian was not the only one to notice. When the prayer was done, Septon Marybold looked across the table and said, "Do you have no love for the gods, son?"
"Not for your gods."
Gendry stood abruptly.
"I have work to do."
He stalked out without a bite of food. "Is there some other god he loves?" asked Hyle Hunt.
"The Lord of Light,"
piped one scrawny boy, nigh to six. Willow hit him with a spoon.
"Ben Big Mouth, there's food. You should be eating it, not bothering me lords with talk."
The children fell upon their supper like wolves upon a wounded deer, quarrelling over codfish, tearing the barley bread to pieces, and getting porridge everywhere. Even the huge wheel of cheese did not long survive. Brian contented herself with fish and bread and carrots, while Septon Marybold fed two morsels to Dog for everyone he ate himself. Outside, a rain began to fall. Inside, the fire crackled, and the common room was filled by the sounds of chewing and Willow smacking children with her spoon. "One day that little girl will make some man a frightful wife," Sir Hyle observed.
"That poor prince's boy, most like. Someone should take him some food before it's all gone."
"You're someone." She wrapped a wedge of cheese, a heel of bread, a dried apple, and two chunks of flaky fried cod in a square of cloth. When Podrick got up to follow her outside, she told him to sit back down and eat.
"I will not be long."
The rain was coming down heavy in the yard. Brian covered the food with a fold of her cloak. Some of the horses whinnied at her as she made her way past the stables.
They are hungry, too.
Gendry was at his forge, bare-chested beneath his leather apron. He was beating on a sword as if he wished it were a foe, his sweat-soaked hair falling across his brow. She watched him for a moment.
He has Renly's eyes and Renly's hair, but on his build, Lord Renly was more lithe than brawny. Not like his brother Robert, whose strength was fabled.
It was not until he stopped to wipe his brow that Gendry saw her standing there.
"What do you want?" "I brought supper."
She opened the cloth for him to see.
"If I wanted food, I would have eaten some. A smith needs to eat to keep his strength up. Are you my mother?"
"No."
She put down the food.
"Who was your mother?" "What's that to you? You were born in King's Landing."
The way he spoke made her certain of it.
"Me and many more."
He plunged the sword into a tub of rainwater to quench it. The hot steel hissed angrily.
"How old are you?"
Brian asked.
"Is your mother still alive? And your father, who was he?" "You ask too many questions."
He set down the sword.
"My mother's dead, and I never knew my father."
"You're a bastard."
He took it for an insult.
"I'm a knight. That sword will be mine own once it's done."
"What would a knight be doing working at a smithy?" "You have black hair and blue eyes, and you were born in the shadow of the Red Keep. Has no one ever remarked upon your face?" "What's wrong with my face? It's not as ugly as yours." "In King's Landing, you must have seen King Robert."
He shrugged.
"Sometimes, at tourneys, from afar. Once at Baelor Sept. The gold cloaks shoved us aside so he could pass. Another time I was playing near the Mudgate when he come back from a hunt. He was so drunk he almost rode me down. A big, fat sot he was, but a better king than these sons of his." "They are not his sons. Stannis told it true. That day he met with Renly. Joffrey and Tommen were never Robert's sons. This boy, though." "Listen to me,"
Brian began. Then she heard dog barking, loud and frantic.
"Someone is coming."
"Friends,"
said Gendry, unconcerned.
"What sort of friends?"
Brian moved to the door of the smithy to peer out through the rain. He shrugged.
"You'll meet them soon enough."
"I may not want to meet them,"
Brian thought, as the first riders came splashing through the puddles into the yard. Beneath the patter of the rain and dogs barking, she could hear the faint clink of swords and mail from beneath their ragged cloaks. She counted them as they came.
2, 4, 6, 7.
Some of them were wounded, judging from the way they rode. The last man was massive and hulking, as big as two of the others. His horse was blown and bloody, staggering beneath his weight. All the riders had their hoods up against the lashing rain, save him alone. His face was broad and hairless, maggot white, his round cheeks covered with weeping sores. Brian sucked in her breath and drew Oathkeeper.
"Too many," she thought with a start of fear. "There are too many." "Gendry,"
she said in a low voice,
"you'll want a sword and armor. These are not your friends. They're no one's friends. What are you talking about?"
The boy came and stood beside her, his hammer in his hand. Lightning cracked to the south as the riders swung down off their horses. For half a heartbeat, darkness turned to day. An axe gleamed silvery blue, light shimmering off mail and plate, and beneath the dark hood of the lead rider, Brian glimpsed an iron snout and rows of steel teeth, snarling. Gendry saw it too.
"Him? Not him. His helm."
Brian tried to keep the fear from her voice, but her mouth was dry as dust. She had a pretty good notion who wore the hound's helm.
"The children,"
she thought. The door to the inn banged open. Willis stepped out into the rain, a crossbow in her hands. The girl was shouting at the riders. but a clap of thunder rolled across the yard, drowning out her words. As it faded, Brian heard the man in the hound's helm say,
"Loose a quarrel at me, and I'll shove that crossbow up your cunt, and fuck you with it. Then I'll pop your fucking eyes out and make you eat 'em."
The fury in the man's voice drove Willow back a step, trembling.
"Seven?"
Brian thought again, despairing. She had no chance against seven. She knew.
No chance, and no choice.
She stepped out into the rain, Oathkeeper in hand.
"Leave her be! If you want to rape someone, try me!"
The outlaws turned as one. One laughed, and another said something in a tongue Brian did not know. The huge one, with a broad white face, gave a malevolent hiss. The man in the hound's helm began to laugh.
"You're even uglier than I remembered. I'd sooner rape your horse."
"Horses is what we want,"
one of the wounded men said.
"Fresh horses and some food. There are outlaws after us. Give us your horses and we'll be gone. We won't do you harm."
"Fuck that."
The outlaw in the hound's helm yanked a battle axe off his saddle.
"I want to cut her bloody legs off. I'll set her on her stumps so she can watch me fuck the crossbow girl."
"With what?"
taunted Brian.
"Shagwell said they cut your manor off when they took your nose."
She meant it to provoke him, and it did. Bellowing curses, he came at her, his feet sending up splashes of black water as he charged. The others stood back to watch the show, as she had prayed they might. Brian stayed as still as stone, waiting. The yard was dark, the mud slippery underfoot.
"Better to let him come to me. If the guards were good, he'll slip and fall."
The guards were not that good, but her sword was.
"Five steps, four steps, no!"
Brian counted. An Oathkeeper swept up to meet his rush. Steel crashed against steel as her blade bit through his rags and opened a gash in his chainmail, even as his axe came crashing down at her. She twisted aside, slashed at his chest again as she retreated. He followed, staggering and bleeding, roaring rage.
"Whore!"
he boomed.
"Freak! Bitch! I'll give you my dog to fuck, you bloody bitch!"
His axe whirled in murderous arcs, a brutal black shadow that turned silver every time the lightning flashed. Brian had no shield to catch the blows. All she could do was slide back away from him, darting this way and that as the axe head flew at her. Once the mud gave way under her heel and she almost fell, but somehow she recovered herself, though the axe grazed her left shoulder that time and left a blaze of pain in its wake.
"You got the bitch!"
one of the others called, and another said,
"Let's see her dance away from that one."
Dance she did, relieved that they were watching. Better that than have them interfere. She could not fight seven, not alone, even if one or two were wounded. Old Sir Goodwin was long in his grave, yet she could hear him whispering in her ear.
"A man will always underestimate you," he said, "and their pride will make them want to vanquish you quickly, lest it be said that a woman tried them sorely. Let them spend their strength in furious attacks, while you conserve your own. Wait and watch, girl. Wait and watch."
She waited, watching, moving sideways, then backwards, then sideways again, slashing now at his face, now at his legs, now at his arm. His blows came more slowly as his axe grew heavier. Brian turned him, so the rain was in his eyes, and stepped back two quick steps. He wrenched his axe up once more, cursing, and lurched after her, one foot sliding in the mud. And she leapt to meet his rush, both hands on her sword hilt. His headlong charge brought him right onto her point. An Oathkeeper punched through cloth and mail and leather and more cloth deep into his bowels and out his back, rasping as it scraped along his spine. His axe fell from limp fingers, and the two of them slammed together. Brian's face mashed up against the dog's head helm,
She felt the cold, wet metal against her cheek. Rain ran down the steel in rivers, and when the lightning flashed again, she saw pain and fear and rank disbelief through the eye slits.
"Sapphires!"
she whispered at him, and she gave her blade a hard twist that made him shudder. His weight sagged heavily against her, and all at once it was a corpse that she embraced. There, in the black rain, she stepped back and let him fall. And Biter crashed into her, shrieking. He fell on her like an avalanche of wet wool and milk-white flesh, lifting her off her feet and slamming her down into the ground. She landed in a puddle with a splash that sent water up her nose and into her eyes. All the air was driven out of her, and her head snapped down against some half-buried stone with a crack.
"No!"
was all that she had time to say, before he fell on top of her, his weight driving her deeper into the mud. One of his hands was in her hair, pulling her head back. The other groped for her throat. Oathkeeper was gone, torn from her grasp. She had only her hands to fight him off. But when she slammed a fist into his face, it was like punching a ball of wet white dough. He hissed at her. She hit him again, 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 smashing the heel of her hand into his eye, but he did not seem to feel her blows. She clawed at his wrists. But his grip just grew tighter, though blood ran from the gouges where she stretched him. He was crushing her, smothering her. She pushed at his shoulders to get him off her, but he was heavy as a horse, impossible to move. When she tried to knee him in the groin, all she did was drive her knee into his belly. Grunting, Biter tore out a handful of her hair.
"My dagger!"
Brian clutched at the thought, desperate. She worked her hand down between them, fingers squirming under his sour, suffocating flesh, searching until they finally found the hilt. Biter locked both his hands about her neck and began to slam her head against the ground. The lightning flashed again, this time inside her skull. Yet somehow her fingers tightened, pulled the dagger from its sheath. With him on top of her, she could not raise the blade to stab, so she drew it hard across his belly. Something warm and wet gushed between her fingers. Biter hissed again, louder than before, and let go of her throat just long enough to smash her in the face. She heard bones crack, and the pain blinded her for an instant. When she tried to slash at him again, he wrenched the dagger from her fingers and slammed a knee down onto her forearm, breaking it. Then he seized her head again and resumed trying to tear it off her shoulders. Brian could hear dog barking, and men were shouting all about her, and between the claps of thunder she heard the clash of steel on steel.
"Sahil," she thought, "Sahil has joined the fight."
But all that seemed far away and unimportant. Her world was no larger than the hands at her throat and the face that loomed above her. The rain ran off his hood as he leaned closer. His breath stank like cheese gone rotten. Brian's chest was burning, and the storm was behind her eyes, blinding her. Bones ground against each other inside of her. Biter's mouth gaped open, impossibly wide. She saw his teeth, yellow and crooked, filed into points. When they closed on the soft meat of her cheek, she hardly felt it. She could feel herself spiraling down into the dark.
"I cannot die yet," she told herself. "There's something I still need to do."
Biter's mouth tore free, full of blood and flesh. He spat, grinned, and sank his pointed teeth into her flesh again. This time he chewed and swallowed.
"He is eating me,"
she realized, but she had no strength left to fight him any longer. She felt as if she were floating above herself, watching the horror, as if it were happening to some other woman, to some stupid girl who thought she was a knight.
"It'll be finished soon," she told herself. "Then it will not matter if he eats me."
Biter threw back his head and opened his mouth again, howling, and stuck his tongue out at her. It was sharply pointed, dripping blood, longer than any tongue should be, sliding from his mouth out and out and out, red and wet and glistening. It made a hideous sight, obscene.
His tongue is a foot long,
Brian thought, just before the darkness took her.
Why, it looks almost like a sword.
Jamie. The brooch that fastened Sir Brendan Tolly's cloak was a black fish, wrought in jet and gold. His ringmail was grim and grey. Over it he wore greaves, a gorget, gauntlets, pauldron, and pauline's of blackened steel, none half so dark as the look upon his face, as he waited for Jaime Lannister at the end of the drawbridge. Alone atop a chestnut courser, caparisoned in red and blue. "He loves me not." Tully had a craggy face, deeply lined and windburnt, beneath a shock of stiff grey hair. But Jaime could still see the great knight who had once enthralled a squire with tales of the Ninepenny Kings. Honor's hoofs clattered against the planks of the drawbridge. Jaime had thought long and hard about whether to wear his gold armor or his white to this meeting. In the end he'd chosen a leather jack and a crimson cloak. He drew up a yard from Sir Brendan, and inclined his head to the older man. "Kingslayer?" said Tolly. That he would make that name the first word from his mouth spoke volumes, but Jaime was resolved to keep his temper. "Blackfish?" he responded. "Thank you for coming. I assume you have returned to fulfill the oaths you swore, my niece," Sir Brendan said. "As I recall, you promised Caitlin her daughters in return for your freedom." His mouth tightened. "Yet I do not see the girls. Where are they?" "Must he make me say it?" "I do not have them."
"Oh, pity.
Do you wish to resume your captivity? Your old cell is still available. We have put fresh rushes on the floor."
And a nice new pail for me to shit in, I don't doubt."
"That was thoughtful of you, sir, but I fear I must decline. I prefer the comforts of my pavilion. Whilst Caitling enjoys the comforts of her grave."
"I had no hand in Lady Caitlin's death," he might have said, "and her daughters were gone before I reached King's Landing." It was on his tongue to speak of Brienne and the sword he'd given her. But the Blackfish was looking at him the way that Eddard Stark had looked at him when he found him on the Iron Throne with a mad king's blood upon his blade. "I came to speak of the living, not the dead, of those who need not die, but shall, unless I hand you Riverrun. Is this where ye threaten to hang Edmure?" Beneath his bushy brows, Tully's eyes were stone. "My nephew is marked for death no matter what I do. So hang him, and be done with it. I expect Edmure is as weary of standing on those gallows as I am of seeing him there."
"Ryman Frey is a bloody fool. His mummer's show with Edmure and the gallows had only made the Blackfish more obdurate. That was plain. You hold Lady Sybil Westerling and three of her children. I'll return your nephew in exchange for them.
As you returned Lady Caitlin's daughters?"
Jaime did not allow himself to be provoked. "An old woman and three children for your liege lord? That's a better bargain than you could have hoped for." Sir Brendan smiled a hard smile.
"You do not lack for gall, Kingslayer. Bargaining with oathbreakers is like building on quicksand, though. Cat should have known better than to trust the likes of you."
"It was Tyrion she trusted in," Jaime almost said. "The imp deceived her, too. The promises I made to Lady Caitlin were wrung from me at sword point.
And the oath you swore to Ares."
He felt his phantom fingers twitching.
"Ares is no part of this. Will you exchange the Westerlings for Edmure?" "No. My king entrusted his queen to my keeping, and I swore to keep her safe. I will not hand her over to a Frey noose."
"The girl has been pardoned. No harm will come to her. You have my word on it."
"Your word of honor?"
Sir Brendan raised an eyebrow.
"Do you even know what honor is?"
"A horse?"
"I will swear any oath that you require."
"Oh, spare me, Kingslayer."
"I want to." Strike your banners and open your gates, and I'll grant your men their lives. Those who wish to remain at Riveron in service to Lord Emmon may do so. The rest shall be free to go where they will, though I will require them to surrender their arms and armour. I wonder how far will they get, unarmed, before outlaws set upon them. I dare not allow them to join Lord Beric. We both know that. And what of me? Will I be paraded through King's Landing to die like Eddard Stark? I will permit you to take the Black. Ned Stark's bastard is the Lord Commander on the Wall. The Blackfish narrowed his eyes.
Did your father arrange for that as well?
Catelyn never trusted the boy, as I recall, no more than she ever trusted Theon Greyjoy. It was shame she was right about them both. Oh, no, sir, I think not. I'll die warm, if you please, with a sword in my hand running red with lion blood. Tully blood runs just as red, Jamie reminded him. If you will not yield the castle, I must storm it. Hundreds will die. Hundreds of mine, thousands of yours. Your garrison will perish to a man. I know that song. Do you sing it to the tune of the Rains of Castamere? My men would sooner die upon their feet fighting than on their knees beneath a headsman's axe. This is not going well. This defiance serves no purpose, sir. The war is done, and your young wolf is dead, murdered in breach of all the sacred laws of hospitality. Praise work, not mine. Call it what you will. It stinks of Tywin Lannister. Jamie could not deny that. My father is dead as well. May the father judge him justly. Now, there's an awful prospect. I would have slain Robb Stark in the Whispering Wood, if I could have reached him. Some fools got in the way. Does it matter how the boy perished? He is no less dead, and his kingdom died when he did. You must be blind as well as maimed, sir. Lift your eyes, and you will see that the dire wolf still flies above our walls. I've seen him. He looks lonely. Harrenhal has fallen. Seagard and Maidenpool. The Brackens have bent the knee, and they've got Titus Blackwood penned up in Raventree. Piper, Vance, Mouton, all your bannermen have yielded. Only River Run remains. We have 20 times your numbers. 20 times the men require 20 times the food. How well are you provisioned, my lord? Oh, well enough to sit here till the end of days, if need be, whilst you starve inside your walls. He told the lie as boldly as he could, and hoped his face did not betray him. The Blackfish was not deceived. The end of your days, perhaps. Our own supplies are ample, though I fear we did not leave much in the fields for visitors. We can bring food down from the Twins, said Jamie, or over the hills from the west, if it comes to that. If you say so, far be it from me to question the word of such an honourable knight. The scorn in his voice made Jamie bristle. There is a quicker way to decide the matter. A single combat? My champion against yours? I was wondering when you would get to that. Sir Brynden laughed. Who will it be? Strungbor? Adam Marbrant? Black Walder Frey? He leaned forward. Why not you and me, sir? That would have been a sweet fight once, Jamie thought. Fine fodder for the singers. When Lady Catelyn freed me, she made me swear not to take arms again against the Starks or Tullys. A most convenient oath, sir. His face darkened. Are you calling me a coward? No, I'm calling you a cripple. The Blackfish nodded at Jamie's golden hand. We both know you cannot fight with that. I had 2 hands. Would you throw your life away for pride? A voice inside him whispered. Some might say a cripple and an old man are well matched. Free me from my vow to Lady Catelyn, and I will meet you sword to sword. If I win, River Run is ours. If you slay me, we'll lift the siege. Sir Brynden laughed again. Much as I would welcome the chance to take the golden sword away from you and cut out your black heart. Your promises are worthless, I have gained nothing from your death but the pleasure of killing you, and I will not risk my own life for that, as small a risk as that may be." It was a good thing that Jamie wore no sword, elsewise he would have ripped his blade out, and if Sir Brynden did not slay him, the archer on the walls most surely would. "Are there any terms you will accept?" he demanded of the Blackfish. "From you?" Sir Brynden shrugged. "No." "Why did you even come to treat with me?" "A siege is deadly dull. I wanted to see this stump of yours, and hear whatever excuses ye cared to offer up for your latest enormities. They were feebler than I hoped." "Ye always disappoint, Kingslayer." The Blackfish wheeled his mare and trotted back toward Riveron. The portcullis descended with a rush, its iron spikes biting deep into the muddy ground. Jamie turned Honor's head about for the long ride back to the Lannister siege lines. He could feel the eyes on him, the Tully men upon their battlements, the Freys across the river. "If they are not blind, they'll all know he threw my offer in my teeth." He would need to storm the castle. Well, that's one more broken vow to the Kingslayer. Just more shit in the bucket. Jamie resolved to be the first man on the battlements, and with this golden hand of mine, most like the first to fall. Back at camp, little Lou held his bridle, whilst Peck gave him a hand down from the saddle. "Do they think I'm such a cripple that I cannot dismount by myself?" "How did you fare, my lord?" asked his cousin, Sir Devon. "No one put an arrow in my horse's rump, elsewise there was little to distinguish me from Sir Ryman." He grimaced. "So now he must needs turn the red fork redder." "Blame yourself for that, Blackfish. You left me little choice." "Assemble a war council. Sir Adam, Strongbore, Forley Prester, those river lords of ours, and our friends of Frey, Sir Ryman, Lord Emmon, whoever else they care to bring." They gathered quickly. Lord Piper and both Lords Vance came to speak for the repentant lords of the Trident, whose loyalties would shortly be put to the test. The West was represented by Sir Davin, Strongbore, Adam Marbrant, and Forley Prester. Lord Emmon Frey joined them with his wife. Lady Jenner claimed her stool with a look that dared any man there to question her presence. None did. The Frey sent Sir Walder Rivers, called Bastard Walder, and Sir Ryman's firstborn Edwin, a pallid, slender man with a pinched nose and lank, dark hair. Under a blue lambswool cloak, Edwin wore a jerkin of finely tooled grey calfskin, with ornate scrollwork worked into the leather.
"I speak for House Frey," he announced. "My father is indisposed this morning."
Sir Davin gave a snort. "Is he drunk, or just green sick from last night's wine?" Edwin had the hard, mean mouth of a miser.
"Lord Jamie," he said, "must I suffer such discourtesy?"
"Is it true?" Jamie asked him. "Is your father drunk?" Frey pressed his lips together and eyed Sir Ilion Payne, who was standing beside the tent flap in his rusted mail, his sword poking up above one bony shoulder.
"He, my father, has a bad belly, my lord. Red wine helps with his digestion."
"He must be digesting a bloody mammoth," said Sir Davin. Strongbore laughed, and Lady Jenner chuckled. "Enough," said Jamie. "We have a castle to win." When his father sat in council, he let his captain speak first. He was resolved to do the same. "How shall we proceed?"
"Hang Edmure Tully for a start,"
urged Lord Emmon Frey.
"That will teach Sir Brynden that we mean what we say. If we send Sir Edmure's head to his uncle, it may move him to yield."
"Brynden Blackfish is not moved so easily."
Carl Vance, the Lord of Wayfarer's Rest, had a melancholy look. A wine-stained birthmark covered half his neck and one side of his face.
"His own brother could not move him to a marriage bed."
Sir Davin shook his shaggy head. "We have to storm the walls, as I've been saying all along. Siege towers, scaling ladders, a ram to break the gate. That's what's needed here."
"I will lead the assault," said Strongbore. Give the fish a taste of steel and fire. That's what I say.
They are my walls,
protested Lord Emmon.
And it is my gate you would break.
He drew his parchment out of his sleeve again.